OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
All right, this morning on OTB AM, we're looking at a new sports book, Charlie, the story of Charlie Gallagher, the GAA's lost icon. I'm delighted to say that Paul Fitzpatrick, sports writer with the Anglo South, is with us in the studio this morning. Paul, how are you?
Not too bad, Tommy.
Paul, this book, Charlie, right, we're going to start off, we're going to let people know you're a Cavan man. So, when I started reading this, Charlie Gallagher, the story of Charlie, a footballer in the 50s and the 60s, I was asking myself, how did I not know who Charlie Gallagher was? And I've asked a couple of people since, and they didn't know. And it's striking that on the front page, now it is a striking image of Charlie Gallagher there, it's striking on the front page and in the title of the book, he's called the GAA's lost icon. How is he lost? Like for you, as a Cavan boy growing up, did you know all about Charlie Gallagher?
Yeah, I've heard about him. So I would have heard about him from my grandfather who followed Cavan in the 60s. And this story is typical of Cavan supporters because the last match my granddad ever went to was the 1969 Ulster final. And Charlie retired after that. And I asked him, why did you stop following Cavan in 69? And he said, well, Charlie retired. And he said, it wasn't the same. It's like, it's hard to describe what a hero he was in the 1960s in small town Ireland. Like I said to someone recently that Charlie in his heyday was bigger in we'll say small town Cavan than the likes of Ronaldo or Messi is now. And I know that sounds foolish to say that, but you weren't as exposed to these sort of, you know, demigods as you are now. You didn't have all that TV coverage and all that. And here was this absolute icon walking amongst you, you know, the word made flesh. And we'll say in 1984, the GAA named their team of the century. Charlie didn't win in All-Ireland, but talking to people around that time, a lot of them said if Charlie had got an All-Ireland medal, he would have been on the team of the century. On the same night, the GAA named the greatest team never to win in All-Ireland. Like, Charlie was on that in 1984. So that was his status. But over the years, he sort of, I don't know, his reputation, probably from not winning an All-Ireland, he probably doesn't have the status that he should have in terms of an icon of the game. Now, I know he was, the Independent did 125 greatest players a few years ago for the 125 of the GAA, and he was in it at number 94. So, like, when you consider the thousands of great players, he's still pretty high, but he probably should have been higher.
His status is there, and he's really important. His brother Brian, we'll get into his family in a few minutes, and we'll get into the fact that he's compared to George Best, the George Best of Gaelic football, and that's a very striking comparison. We'll get into some of the off-field issues later on, but like on the field, what type of footballer was Charlie Gallagher?
Yeah, well, there's a chapter in the book called The Making of a Marksman, and where I talk about it at length because his style was something unique. And from talking to his teammates and opponents and stuff like that for interviews, a lot of them talked about his style. He was extremely quick. He was an absolute rocket off the mark. Most players I spoke to said he was the quickest player they had ever witnessed. He wasn't a man for the rough stuff. Yeah. And people would say that with a chuckle because Charlie, some people would say maybe he was a bit windy. I don't know if he was windy, but you have to imagine that the full back line in the 60s was shark infested waters. Like they just wanted to stop a man from playing, and he got away with it back then. So Charlie would have come in for a lot of rough treatment. His balance was a big thing. He was known for, he was almost airborne when he gathered possession. So if he got a hit, you couldn't knock him. He almost went up instead of going down. And then he was a free taker. He regularly topped the scoring charts. Almost every year in the 1960s, the Sunday Independent used to keep a list of the top scorers every week. Okay. And almost every year in the 60s, in the top three, and he topped it on three occasions. There was one year he actually scored more than the highest scorer in Hurling, which was Eddie Kerr that year. So like, he was an absolute icon. Ray Carlin, who was probably the best known Cavan player of that era, he says that Charlie would never score ordinary points. He always scored spectacular points.
Really?
And he was known for these huge, big, high points that would bend in. And then when he would score a point, the biggest thing he had was his charisma. So when he would score a point, he'd walk out to Ray Carlin and one of his teammates and he'd go, what do you think of that? You know, and this could be a big game in Croke Park. He had this sort of charisma. So I interviewed Seamus Hoare, who was a Ulster Railway Cup player, Donegal man, a goalkeeper in the 60s, and was friendly with Charlie. And the way he described him was, he said he was the sort of man that comes along once in a lifetime because he had the ultimate combination of incredible skill, and he had the looks. Obviously, you can see the photographs of him in the book. Like, he was a very handsome man. That's where the George Best comparison came in as well.
In all the team photos, he jumps out.
Yeah, he does.
He jumps out in all the team photos that are in the book.
Yeah, he does. And the funny thing was, in team photos, he was often in the front and centre, the front row. He just had that.
He's got the hair. He's got the hairstyle. He's got the socks put. You know, he knows he's there to put on a show.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a showman, and he was immaculately turned out, as you say. You know, he had it all. And as you alluded to there, he had a serious off the field problem in later years with alcoholism as well. Which again, the comparison with George Best is relevant there.
I was kind of fascinated by the the building of an icon and how an icon can be created back in the 50s and 60s. Because like when you make the George Best comparison, it is striking. And, you know, it can be an easy one to make as well for someone who's, you know, flashy on the field and so perhaps devastating off it at times. But it's not, it's a complicated story. Like, you've woven it with tales of how Ulster changed at that time and how that affected football in the county and how important football was to society at that time. Like, can we go back to when Charlie was growing up? He grew up in Coot Hill and he had brothers who played football. Did his parents, was his father involved in football?
There's actually a chapter which gives the backstory of the family. So his father was a doctor. He came from Lewisburg in Mayo. And so there's a whole story there. But basically, he was set up to go into the priesthood. This is back in the 1917, 18, around that time. His mother wants him to go into the priesthood. He decided he would do that. He went to Dublin for 6 weeks to study in a seminary and didn't like it and went home. And the story is that his mother, this is Charlie's dad now, his mother said she didn't want any more to do with him because he didn't become a priest. She basically banished him. He went over and lived across the road and lived with his aunt, and she paid for him to go to study to become a doctor. So Charlie's father was a doctor, and he settled in Cavan after a few years, met Charlie's mother, and they had seven children. Charlie was born on Christmas Day in 1937. So again, every little thing you can think of, you know, if you weren't going to be a superstar, what day would you be born? Like, it's Christmas Day. Yeah, it's classic of Charlie. But so he grew up, so they would have had a few quid. He wouldn't have grown up in poverty in Cavan in the 40s. And then he went to study in St. Pat's College in Cavan, which was the kind of leading football academy in Ulster at the time. But the very interesting thing, so when Charlie was a minor, he was better known than a lot of senior intercounty players. And I have quotes in the book from people saying that. You know, he was known as this up-and-coming superstar. So Cavan won five All-Irelands in 19 years, up until 52. 55, they came back and they won the Ulster title. Brian Gallagher, who was Charlie's brother, was on that team. And they lost to Kerry in a replay in the All-Ireland semi-final. So their stock was still very high. And that year, Charlie was 17 and had played with the minors. And there was a big outcry in the county to get him into the senior team. Anyway, they didn't bring him in until that November for the National League. And from that point on, from Charlie made his debut, Cavan didn't win an Ulster title for 7 years. And there had never been a famine like it in Cavan. And people thought this was the end of the world in Cavan because football was really all they had. And immigration was very high. And in rural Cavan, which is a very rural county then and now, you know, with the football team was going so bad. Cavan, up until 1946, Cavan had never trained for an Ulster final. It was just taken as a given. Cavan would win Ulster, and then you would train for an All-Ireland semi-final. But Cavan started to lose. And, you know, you can actually plot, people often ask why did Cavan decline so badly? But you can actually trace it back to that period.
You can see it in the book, yeah.
Yeah, from 55 to 62, because the Northern team started to rise up in that period. So I mentioned there's a famous photograph from 1956 where Tyrone won the first Ulster title, and there's a Tyrone forward running out and he's wagging his finger at the crowd like that, and he just scored a goal, and the Cavan goalkeeper Seamus Morris is on the ground. Tyrone hammered Cavan in the Ulster final in 1956, which was absolutely a monumental shock. In 58, Derry came and won their first Ulster title, and like Derry hadn't even established a county board until the 30s, so they were arriving. And then in 59, to make things worse for Cavan, Down came, hammered Cavan in the Ulster final. 60, Down got the All-Ireland. 61, Down got the All-Ireland again. So by that stage, Cavan were struggling to cope with all these blows they were taking from everywhere. Yeah. And I'd say Charlie didn't know what to expect, because he came in with almost a birthright to win Ulster titles. And here he was, 24, 25, and hadn't won anything.
And you mentioned, like, he was a superstar at minor. And when you mentioned that, how he was talked about at minor more than some senior players, you think about David Clifford and Shaunie O'Shea. Like, but I remember watching Clifford, and you get clips on Twitter or YouTube. And that's how word of mouth spreads nowadays. It's easy, it's quick. Like, nothing's private, everything goes really quickly. How were people hearing about Charlie Gallagher back then?
Yeah, I suppose they were hearing it on the grapevine and maybe seeing match reports. And the point, like, he's got a catchy name, you know. Charlie Gallagher is sort of a catchy name. There's an assonance to it. And I think that he just caught the imagination. So if you look at, say, team sheets with minor teams back in the 50s, if I looked up, Charlie was playing for the Cavan Miners when he was 15, and every player would get their initials. You'd have, you know, P. Fitzpatrick, T. Rooney, whatever it was. And it would come to Charlie, and it was Charlie Gallagher. He got his full name because Charlie was marked out as something special. So obviously then, in 62, Cavan finally made a breakthrough, won Ulster, and they went on and won four Ulster titles in the 60s, Charlie as captain for two of them. But when you're tracing back to the decline of Cavan, you can't trace it back to that era.
Let's stay on that for a moment, because it wasn't just football. It wasn't just Tyrone decided to start training. Ulster changed around that time. And when you're reading the book, you can just tell how, Ulster football awoke. Like, you think back to the Gaelic games then, and perhaps it was a lazy thought of mine, but like, I just thought it was more country people playing. But it was a game for professionals and educated people, and people in Ulster started to become more educated back then.
Yeah, completely. And Paul Rouse is very good on this topic. I spoke to Paul when I was researching this, and he gave me a load of information on this sort of thing. So the phrase he used was racy of the soil. You know, there's this image, as you said, that Cavan, or that country, rural counties were turning out county teams full of farmers and things like that. That was never the case. I have a quote in the book from Jim McDonald, great Cavan player of that era, and he says, no, there was very few farmers. And if you look even at the Cavan team that won in the Polo Grounds, like, you had dentists and army officers and future Taoiseach, and that followed right through. Like, Charlie was a dentist in the 60s. You would have had lots of professionals, doctors, and you had a surgeon playing in goals, this sort of thing. Farmers were too busy. They hadn't time to go and play football back then. So, how things changed in the north then was, post-World War II, a new Labour government came in the UK, and as I said, Paul Rouse is an expert on this. So I'm only passing on really what Paul has informed me, but Clement Attlee was Prime Minister, and I suppose from the horrors of war and all of that, there was sort of a move to the left, and he introduced the NHS and the welfare state and all that, and they brought in free secondary education. So in 1947, you had the Free Education Act in Northern Ireland, which suddenly opened up secondary level education to a whole generation of nationalists who had never got it, who were playing Gaelic games. So they went into schools, and suddenly they were getting exposed to a good level of coaching. And that was 47. If you take lads going in there at 11 or 12 in 47, in 1956, Tyrone won their first Ulster title with a 19-year-old captain, Jody O'Neill. So there's a direct correlation there. And again, 58 Derry, 59 Down. They had been competing in the Ulster Junior Championship at times before that. So, you know, Cavan, maybe we talk about the glorious history of Cavan. We probably had it all to ourselves in Ulster up to that point, up until the 50s.
It does seem like that.
Yeah, no, we have to be honest here. Yeah. We did,
like. No, but like, it's amazing when you look at how obvious the link is to the changes that happened in society at that time and how it developed those counties. Like, that great Down team then came along. And they're a major part of this book in the early 60s because they're a thorn in Cavan's side. And the tables are just turned from 55 to 65 completely. Like.
Yeah, and Cavan were obsessed with beating Down. By the time 62 came around, like, Down had been hammering Cavan, not just beating them, but, you know, there was one game, I think it was the 1959 Ulster final, where they beat Cavan something like 215 to 7 points. And the Down supporters actually climbed up the goalposts. They were just delirious. And there's a quote from Maurice Hayes where he always said that Cavan were like a dragon lying in the path of every Ulster county. If you could, you know, your summer was defined by, you know, how much Cavan would beat you by. But once they got over Cavan, they realised they could go on and win all Ireland. So then the 60s team, Cavan rose again with Charlie and his teammates in the 60s. And that kind of lasted 7 or 8 years. Like, Cavan and Down shared Ulster between them in the 60s. Cavan won 4 and Down won 6. But Cavan beat Down in 4 Ulster finals, 2 of them when they were all Ireland champions. But Cavan never got to All Ireland, so
couldn't get over it.
Like, I've read Martin Brownie before talking about the Cavan team in the '60s, and he said, like, it's commonly acknowledged, it's an absolute mystery how they never won an All Ireland. At 67, I think Charlie was captain. That was the one that got away. They lost to Cork in the All Ireland semi final. And in the book, there's quotes from players saying they think 67 was their best team, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah, it's amazing looking back on it. And then 69 as well. We'll come back to that maybe before we finish. There was probably a bit of consternation about how they let that All Ireland semi-final slip as well. The book opens with a story about Wembley and Cavan going over to play in Wembley. And just reading it, there's a real mystique and kind of magic about these JFK Memorial Games and the teams that have been selected to go over there. Like, what did you think reading back on all those games and these guys going up to London and New York for the first time? Like, it was a major thing for lads from the country to be going over and playing Gaelic games over there.
Oh, absolutely. Like, the other point I forgot to make there was about the immigration of Cavan. So Cavan was one of the worst hit counties for immigration. But in these places outside the county, you had thousands of Cavan people there. Literally thousands of Cavan people, would say, in London. And they came from Coventry and Birmingham and everywhere. And they all flooded into the capital when Cavan got to Wembley to play. So Charlie captained Cavan to win 2 Wembley tournaments. Those games were screened live on RTE. In 66, they beat Sligo. And that game was played 6 weeks after the World Cup final in 1966 in the same stadium.
In Wembley, yeah.
Yeah, there's a quote there from Tony Morris, who was on the team. He says that they were used to togging out at the back of a ditch, and here they were in these almost, he described it as like gold-plated bats and stuff like that. You know, the stuff that Bobby Moore and Pella and all these fellas had experienced. So, like, it was absolutely out of this world. In 67, Cavan beat Galway in the final, and they were three in a row All-Ireland winners. Cavan beat them by a point, Charlie with the winning point. And there's an iconic photograph in the book of Charlie going up to receive the cup in the Royal Box. It's probably the most famous picture of him, and you can see like he looks like a modern day person. He's so well groomed, and his teeth are perfect. And you know, people in the '60s looked different, but yeah. he looked like someone we expect to see now.
Yeah. It's a fantastic story, and like it's when you're reading it, you're just like, how do I not know who this is? How have I not heard of this man? He was such a major figure in Gaelic games back then. And it struck me reading it as well that it's such a pity we don't have an absolute record of the top scorers in Gaelic games, that we can't look back and say, well, Charlie Gallagher is number 54 or 46. And
it's a shame. And like at one point in the 60s, it was reckoned that Charlie was the highest scorer of all time at one point in the 60s, but records were sketchy. I thought you were going to say that we don't have footage, because unfortunately there's no footage of Charlie. Bar one of those games in Wembley, there's some amateur footage.
Is there no archive footage of Charlie Gallagher?
No, nobody can find any footage of Charlie, because he didn't play in an All-Ireland final, and footage hasn't shown up.
That's such a pity.
Yeah, it's an awful
pity.
Even his family haven't seen footage of him playing. But there is this amateur footage from Wembley, and it's amazing. There's actually a streaker who runs on the pitch at one stage, so mad stuff.
One of my favourite stories in the book, and perhaps it's because I'm just over the Cavan border in Meath, but it was Charlie. He was seen as probably, he wasn't a great trainer, say. And you mentioned earlier on that he could have been seen as being a bit flashy maybe, and he was a bit soft perhaps. But in terms of free taking and perfecting the craft, like I've heard Shawnee Shea talking about how much hours he puts into practicing frees. Gallagher, there's a story of Charlie Gallagher practicing frees in Breffni Park, and he'd only dropped the ball a certain length over the bar because he was afraid that the young lads he had with him would get into danger around the river.
That's right, yeah.
And Shawnee Boylan comes up as well.
Yeah, so Sean, when Charlie was in UCD, there was a fellow called Jim McCabe. Go back to what we were saying about professionals. This guy called Jim McCabe, who played with the Cavan team in 1952, he went in to teach him, but he actually ended up something like chief financial officer in the World Bank based in Paris. And he was a Cavan man. He was from Mullaghorne, I think. But he's still alive, actually, in Sligo. But at this time, Jim McCabe was teaching. And he was teaching in Clogher Road, which is like a technical college over near Crumlin somewhere. And Charlie was in UCD. So Charlie used to go and practice his frees with Jim McCabe. On a Wednesday, Jim McCabe would bring the students down for football and hurling practice. And one of them was a young Sean Boylan, who had gone to Belvedere, but he was doing a year or two in this after he finished. And he used to go down, and his job was to catch the ball and give it back to Charlie. And I rang him up, and he was delighted to chat about it. But he always said that he used to tell the Meath players, like O'Rourke and all those great players on the Meath teams, about the importance of making the most of the time you have to practice. So he said Charlie would come along, and if he was practicing frees for an hour, you know, it was an intense hour, and he would get it right. And that's why he became he was the greatest free taker of his era.
We mentioned how it's as much about the GAA and society and ulster at the time. We might jump ahead to the end of Cavan football for Charlie Gallagher, because it was a sad enough end. But before we kind of come to his retirement and stuff, he lived in Derry. He had a dental practice in Derry, so he was in Derry in the '70s. So, when you, it's such a shame that his life ended the way perhaps it did, and you know the comparisons to George Best start there with the alcoholism off the field. It was tough for him after he finished football. He found it difficult.
Yeah, see, Charlie was a man who never really grew up. A lot of people have used that expression to describe Charlie. So he was like a young fella who loved the crack. He was childlike and he'd be enthusiastic about things. And I was trying to figure out, you know, where this alcoholism came from with Charlie. Talking to his family, who were unbelievable, helped with the book. You know, the theory that they came up with was that he was. First of all, Derry was a soccer town. It wasn't a big Gaelic town. And so Charlie was sort of removed from the source of his celebrity straight away. I won't say he might as well have been out of the country, but Derry wasn't a big Gaelic town. He wasn't meeting Gaelic football people on the street every day like he would have been. So for a man like Charlie, who loved the limelight and the celebrity, that was probably a shock to the system. Then he was running a business. Then he had stopped playing and he maybe had got out of shape. He wasn't used to this routine. And addicts need routine. And he lost that. He wasn't getting in his car driving to Coolhill. And he drove a sports car, that was the other thing as well. But he wasn't getting in his car driving to Coolhill or Cavan to train. That was gone as well. He had three children, he had a wife. See, all these things happened in a short space of time. Plus, he was basically living in a war zone. You know, where his surgery was in Clarendon Street, like the CS gas would be wafting up the street, you know, it'd be coming in the windows. It was that close to the areas where this real conflict was happening. And there's stories in the book about his wife Maureen's car being hijacked. And at one stage, a rumour went around that Charlie had been assassinated. and there was people rioting, throwing stones in the street. And I heard that from a friend of mine from Derry, grew up at the time. His father was a doctor, friendly with Charlie, and he remembers as a teenager this happening. So it was a totally surreal situation he found himself in. And then he had his problems with alcoholism. Then there would have been a measure of regret at the end of the 60s, because Cavan were still holding themselves to sort of a standard from a different era. Like, there would have been a feeling that Cavan had failed in the 60s, even though we look back on it now as a glorious era. Mm. But there would have been probably a bit of regret there with him as well, that Cavan didn't get an All-Ireland and they held themselves to a really high standard. So yeah, all of that combined, and I don't know, maybe it was genetic as well, but yeah, he had a very bad time with alcoholism. And to be fair to the Gallagher family, like, they were very open about it, and his teammates. And there was one really sad story, probably the saddest story in the book. One of his teammates told me how he met Charlie at a match years later, and Charlie had a good few drinks on him, and he was the worse for wear. And he decided, I won't call it an intervention, but he decided he'd try and have a word with him. And he said to him, you know, Charlie, why don't you come and play golf with us? He said, some of us, the lads that used to play together in the football field, he said, we're playing golf. He said, we're no good, but it's a good hobby and stuff like that. And he said, for a second, he thought he was getting through to Charlie. And then he just said, do you remember the time you kicked the ball down to me and I put it over the bar? And he said, for a split second, it was like I could get through to him. And then it was back to football chat. So he never moved on from it, which is probably a common thread with sports people as well, sadly.
Yeah. Look, we don't want to give everything away from the book. Like, it's a brilliant book. It's really, I think it'll strike home with a lot of people, because there's a lot that resonates with people. There's a star, the superstar, there's the troubles as well. Like, I think when you read it, you think of every club in the country probably has somebody that was close to this or similar enough to this. It's a magical story about a footballer that we really should know a lot more about. It's Charlie, the story of Charlie Gallagher, the GAA's lost icon. It's definitely going to be top of the Christmas list for a lot of people this Christmas. Can the good days ever come back for Cavan football? Can it ever go back around in a circle again in Ulster?
It's a hard question to ask. I think it's accepted by some of the Cavan players. I know a friend of mine did an interview with one of the Cavan players yesterday, which hasn't been released yet, and he was saying how Tyrone and Donegal are ahead of Cavan in terms of strength and condition. That, I think that's accepted by the Cavan players. They believe that the young players coming into the Tyrone and Donegal teams are lagging behind in strength and conditions. That's one thing that needs to be addressed. Cavan have appointed a full-time strength and condition coach to work at all levels, which should help that. Can it come around again? The population of Cavan is rising, which is, you know, if you're going to break it down to the nuts and bolts, it is a numbers game. And traditionally, we would have had slightly bigger population than Monaghan, for example, but the projections are now that our population is going to be significantly bigger than Monaghan in the years to come. So. Okay. If we can beat Monaghan, we'd be happy.
Yeah, exactly. If you can beat Monaghan, we'd be happy. Paul, thanks for coming into OTBM this morning.
Thanks very much, Tommy, for having me.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.